Never. Never. And never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another and suffer the indignity and suffer the indignity of being the skunk of the world.
The unmistakable voice of Nelson Mandela on 10 May 1994, after he won the first democratic post-apartheid non-racial elections that were held on 27 April the same year. With these words, Mandela proclaimed the end of the apartheid system in South Africa. But 27 years later, Mandela's legacy is under ongoing attack from a new generation of South Africans and other Africans who question Mandela's idea of a rainbow nation. Some argue that apartheid may be gone by name, but it is very much alive indeed. Welcome to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. My name is Sean Macheza. Here at the State of Power podcast, we are concerned with how power functions, how it mutates, and how it reproduces itself. And today's guest deals explicitly with this problem. On the program today is Nyasha Mboti, who is an associate professor at the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein, South Africa. Nyasha is the founder of a new field of study that he terms apartheid studies, and is soon to publish the first of 4 volumes outlining the scope of the new field. He graciously agreed when I asked him to sit with me and to explain what exactly apartheid studies is, and what follows is our conversation, which is mainly based on the first volume of his series. Before we got into the specific content of apartheid studies, Nyasha spoke at length, very critically, about South Africa's much-lauded transition to democracy. First, he criticized Mandela's Never Again speech as an ineffective political statement that had very little to do with the reality faced by apartheid's victims.
Yes, so if you're saying never and never again, right?
Yeah.
Only as a political, as part of a political declaration, it's not enough to tell apartheid to go away just as part of a slogan, just as part of an announcement. You cannot just proclaim that apartheid is ended and then it ends.
Nyasha argued that the new South Africa should have mentioned apartheid specifically in its constitution as something that would never happen again. However,
in that constitution, in 46,441 words, there's not a single mention of the word apartheid. Not a single mention, right?
Mm-hmm.
The constitution mentions what it calls injustices of the past. Injustices of the past can be 5 minutes ago. The past can be 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, 200 years ago. It can be 500 years. So this is purposely vague.
When I pointed out that South Africa's Bill of Rights has been much praised as one of the most liberal ever drafted, he argued that having a beautiful Bill of Rights is meaningless when people's lived realities are far from dignified.
If South Africa has got this most liberal Bill of Rights in the world, what are the outcomes of that most liberal bill in the world? What do you see on the ground, right? Mm-hmm. South Africa, according to sort of the Gini coefficient, is the most unequal society on earth. That liberal Bill of Rights is compatible with 1 in 2 living in poverty. So 1 in 2 South Africans, as we speak, live in dire poverty.
Mm.
And that Bill of Rights that you just spoke about is compatible with that. Mm-hmm. And there's no crisis. So my argument is apartheid has continued to exist in other ways, by other means, in other forms, through what, in this particular case, I call loopholes. There are loopholes that are created One of them is the constitution itself. The South African constitution is a loophole that allows apartheid to continue and to persist by other means, by other names, but in other forms.
The concept of loopholes comes back over and over again. We then got to the pith of our conversation, and I asked Nyasha to explain to me what he means by apartheid studies.
So, apartheid studies, when you go through the account of it that I've given in the four volumes of my book, is actually an attempt, it's a theory of liberation. It's an attempt to talk about how we can close the loopholes through which apartheid has managed to persist in spite of democracy, in spite of us saying that it has ended. So apartheid studies is a form of loophole closing. It's a loophole closing that attacks what I call the sort of the algorithm of the passbook. Because the passbook is the central instrument of apartheid. And for somebody who is not, you know, who does not have that history of South Africa, but the received history of the passbook is basically that Black people were supposed to carry this document on their person at all times. As long as you're above the age of 16, you're supposed to carry this document. You could not work without it. You could not live in white South Africa because South Africa was white South Africa. You could not live in white South Africa or work in white South Africa without that document. That document became your being. And so the passbook becomes the easiest way, the most metonymic way of talking about apartheid. But apartheid itself is broader and much more systemic than just the passbook. But the passbook is the easiest, the most instrumental way of demonstrating the concept, the whole concept of apartheid. And apartheid studies looks at how the passbook uses a particular loophole to escape and to persist beyond 1994. And this is a paradigm that I then use beyond South Africa to show that when you are talking about oppression and injustice, it utilizes loopholes to continue. Even after you have a law against, let's say, police brutality in France or in the UK or in America, when you see the very next day or a week later, somebody is killed in exactly the same way that the law was trying to prohibit, it opens your eyes to the fact that there are two processes happening here. There's a process of legislating against the brutality and the injustice, and then there's a loophole that allows the injustice to coexist with the law that prohibits it. And so this coexistence, this what I call the good neighborliness, this side-by-sideness is what constitutes apartheid. It's when you see poverty coexisting side-by-side with affluence. It's when you see examples of empowerment existing side-by-side with examples of disempowerment. What it means is they are not incompatible. People might think that they are incompatible, but I show that the structure of social life, the structure of the world basically allows for a good neighborliness of crime scenes and what you might call a world where rights are respected, a world where we are equal, a world where there is no racism. These things live side by side. And so the definition of apartheid, we can borrow from its father, the architect of apartheid, H.F. Verfoot, who said that we could define apartheid as a policy of good neighborliness. It's very, you know, there's no critique of this definition, of this phrase. But when I apply it to my framework, I actually see that good neighborliness happens when you have apartheid persisting in a form that shows you.
So this is like the image you give of the high rises in Sandton with their fancy apartments and all of that, and right across the road you've got Alexandra being the poor adjacent slum,
And I guess that's the same in Cape Town with Imzamo Yetu, right? Being right next to the most
affluent. Hout Bay.
Hout Bay. How different is this from familiar concepts that people have come before? Because I want to really figure out what is the difference in the approach of apartheid studies from the rest of kind of the critical tradition, critical race theory, radical theorists. Because, for instance, Steve Lerner talks about sacrifice zones, and in our previous episode with Hamza Hamushen, we spoke about these places where you've got extractivism going on and communities suffering sort of the negative externalities of that. How different is this from, how different is your approach from these other existing perspectives already?
Yeah, so I do not want to say, to talk about apartheid studies in terms of contrasts or similarities, because my readings incorporate a lot of these traditional approaches that you have just mentioned. The work that I've read, the work that I've incorporated, the insights that I've incorporated, they draw from all these disparate insights into oppression, into injustice, institutionalized racism, post-colonial, decolonial thought, feminism. So I do not see apartheid studies as necessarily
replacing in contrast.
No, absolutely not. But what it does is it simply excavates a framework that either has been missed or a framework that has been bypassed by most of these analyses. So what do I mean by this? So number one is the question of the loopholes that I spoke about. Yeah. But number two is the question of, in my book, what I call the rate of oppression. And the apartheid studies framework in light of the rate of oppression, what it shows us, or what it does, is it defines apartheid in a manner that is in complete contrast to how we would think about it. So I define apartheid in light of this rate of oppression as when the bill of oppression is invoiced on the oppressed themselves. And basically, oppression would not succeed if oppression itself wasn't being paid for by the oppressed themselves. And hence, the perspective of apartheid studies actually turns all these previous analyses of oppression and injustice on their head. Because what it does is it shows that it is the participation of the oppressed that is the critical element here. If we want to put apartheid on trial, we have to look at the invoice, what I call the invoice. We have to look at the things that we are doing that enable oppression to continue without any cost on the oppressor. So the oppressor, I argue in my book, the oppressor is on sabbatical. The oppressor is literally on holiday. That's because the oppressed themselves are continuing the maintenance of oppression, the maintenance of injustice, through by trying to live, for instance, just through trying to have a livelihood, just through trying to educate your children, trying to put food on the table. That is the work of the maintenance of apartheid, because apartheid infects the things you do, the things you love, the things you desire, you know, the things you have always assumed.
This is like the example you gave about for instance, the grandfather, that image struck with me, with the grandfather, because the oppressor sees him as a boy, he has to be a boy, but that has many costs for his family life and for his own ego and his own perspective as a human being.
Absolutely. When you have a family, you go underground into a dangerous mine shaft to dig for gold. You know is dangerous. You know, it's dark, it's dusty. There's TB, there's silicosis, there's falling rocks, earthquakes, there's flooding. But you still go into that dangerous place because livelihood, the only way to extract livelihood is through going into the belly of the beast. That is the only way you're going to extract livelihood.
I could not help here but share this song by the Zimbabwean outfit Parks Afro, which captures the troubles of the miner working under apartheid.
All week long I'm shafted underground to bring back the world underneath. I go down just like another tool, digging deep.
That was the song Working Under the Mine by the Zimbabwean band Parks Afro. And now back to our conversation with Nyasha Mboti as he makes the case for what he calls apartheid studies.
I use the image of a queue to show how the rate of oppression happens, because what apartheid does is it creates the passbook and it creates the pass office. And then look at who queues for the passbook at the pass office. It is Africans who wake up in the morning, 3 a.m., dress up, freshen themselves, and then they travel to the pass office to queue for hours on end, sometimes for days on end. For what? For a passbook. So the point I'm making is, how do you queue for a passbook? You hate the passbook. You know it's a form of injustice. And yet you are queuing for it. Mm-hmm. And so the queue for the passbook becomes an eminent way of showing how the rate of oppression happens. You are not going to get a job without a passbook. You are not going to be allowed to live in the urban area without a passbook.
But what is the alternative for the oppressed, though? I shy away from trying to blame people for allowing themselves to be oppressed as if they have much of a choice.
So apartheid studies does not blame. And so I've never used the word blame, and I would never blame the oppressed for oppression. So at no point, maybe when you listen to it, you hear it almost as if I'm apportioning blame. But what I'm actually doing is allowing us to understand. Almost trying to say, because the problem, in fact, is the traditional approaches to studying colonialism and oppression that end up blaming the victim. If you look at the notion of decolonization of the mind, right? Mm-hmm. There's someone else who is looking at the oppressed as colonized. In other words, is these people who need someone to work on their minds so that they can see that they are oppressed and so that they can reject oppression. And I argue in my book that there's no such thing as colonization of the mind. I actually showed that the oppressed is very clear in their minds in terms of what they are doing when they are waking up in the morning to go and work at a gold mine or at a factory where they know that the pay is so little, but they still have to get up in the morning and work anyway. The perspective of the rate of oppression actually absolves the oppressed from blame. It removes any sort of accusation. It shows that when you are put in that same situation yourself, you would find yourself queuing for a passport.
So they just have the sympathy of the algorithm of the society they're in, essentially.
Yes. So if you study the queue and the rate of oppression properly, you are enabled then to see that the solution, because you asked earlier just now, you asked the question about, okay, what is to be done? And my argument is the problem that we face in terms of the framework that exists about what to do is they look at oppression as a uniform thing. Mm-hmm. They look at oppression as, all the Africans are under the boot of apartheid. And therefore, they try to dismantle oppression using that particular approach. The idea of the rate of oppression actually, de-aggregates oppression and looks at it as a rate, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the rate of exchange, let's say of a currency, it keeps changing every day in relation to different events, in relation to different currencies of different countries. It even changes in relation to who you are buying the money from. Some have a high rate, others have a low rate. And what it means is when we are studying oppression, for instance, I argue that oppression does not happen to all of us in the same time, at the same place, in the same way. Mm-hmm. You start to realize that it's because we are affected by oppression differently. Therefore, when we apply a blanket approach to dealing with this problem, you find somebody who might not be interested at that time or who is busy going to work at that time.
So this is sort of also explaining the lack of solidarity amongst all these people who are themselves oppressed, only that they're oppressed in different ways.
They have a different rate of oppression. So it appears that they are not supporting, they are not in solidarity with you, when in fact, no, it's much more complex than that. If you look at the Sharpeville massacre, right, when the PAC said, let's go to these police stations and hand ourselves in, it wasn't everybody who handed themselves in. Mm-hmm. It was a few hundred people. And in fact, some people were looking at the people who were going to hand themselves in and thinking, I could actually get an opportunity for a job here. And I can, if they are arrested, if they're no longer at work, I can actually get to feed my family now because I can finally get a job because there's an opening there. When you consider such a person who is not joining the march or the protest, you can, if you're using the traditional approach, you can criticize them for not showing solidarity. You can criticize them for not showing consciousness. And apartheid studies as a framework departs from that. Mm-hmm. It actually shows that, no, you must study the person's approach or reaction to what's happening, either to a protest. So you organize a protest in Amsterdam against gender violence.
Well, I have a specific example, for instance, with the Extinction Rebellion protests, for instance, mm-hmm. that were going on here in many parts of Europe, where mm-hmm. Someone like myself was an immigrant mm-hmm. who is on a tenuous sort of residence permit. I could not, unlike I care about the environment, many people care about the environment, but someone like myself would not put themselves on the front line to take the police violence or to get themselves arrested on behalf of the environment, because the impact of that interaction with the law enforcement is very different from someone like myself as for someone who was born and raised in a European country.
So you have a different rate of oppression.
Different rate of oppression.
Yes. And when people don't study that, they're going to criticize you for lacking solidarity. They're going to try to force you. You're going to feel forced to go to that protest. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying if people were to adjust the way they study injustice and oppression and understand that oppression happens there's an exchange rate of oppression.
Yeah, this sounds to me like it's a very similar way of integrating the sort of intersectionality, right, of identities that you can have a woman who is highly educated and has a PhD, drives a Mercedes Benz, is not as oppressed as a mine worker at Marikana, but being a woman in her own space, she is at the mercy of the patriarchy. And if she's a Black woman, that has an extra level of consideration. So it sounds like intersectionality, but in a sort of different way. Am I right in thinking of it that way?
So I wouldn't say it's intersectionality for the reason that intersectionality is rigid, right? Intersectionality looks at the woman who is driving a Mercedes Benz, the Black woman driving a top of the range Mercedes Benz, only in a particular moment of time. And then it freezes that, and then it says, look at her, she's privileged. Uh-huh. And therefore, she faces a different burden. And I'm saying, but when you freeze that, mm-hmm. you are not with her at her workplace.
So the rate of oppression is fluid in that sense.
Yes. Now you get the point that I'm trying to make.
To the specific context in which someone is interacting with.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. It's a constant attempt to show that when we move through different spaces, through different histories and memories and experiences, a different rate is applied at every time. So even that woman, when you see her with her mother, yes, she drives a top of the range vehicle and so on, and she's got a CEO job. But when you look at her relationship with her mother, for instance, you start to see that rate change. Maybe because her mother is still in that situation. Mm-hmm. And she's only the only one who is privileged in a family, and she cannot change the circumstances of a family. She can change her own circumstances. She can't change the circumstances of her brother who is in prison, or of her little sister who is pregnant and who doesn't have a job and so on, and who was raped last night. Mm-hmm. That changes the rate of oppression for that lady. And yet when we freeze it in terms of intersectionality, we simply look at her as a privileged woman. And so apartheid studies, by the time you get to the fourth volume, has introduced a new framework of looking at oppression and injustice in such a way that allows you to see how oppression persists in spite of saying it is no longer there formally, mm-hmm. but also shows how we can study it in ways that finally, mm-hmm. we can show how it really happens, mm-hmm. how it really happens in a way that allows us to then close the loopholes. Because remember what I said about apartheid studies as a loophole closing mechanism.
Yeah.
How do you close the loophole if you do not understand how oppression happens? And apartheid studies tries to offer a framework to say, when you study the rate of oppression, you can finally close the loopholes. But if the loopholes are open, it doesn't matter how conscious you are. It doesn't matter how many people are at your protest, how many millions are at your protest, how many people attended the anti-war protests against the Iraqi war in 2002, 2003, right? Millions in Europe came out on the streets to say no to the Iraq war.
Yeah.
But where are we today? The war happened. Millions of Iraqis have died. The war still happened.
Yeah.
So when you think about it, you start to say, no, I think maybe we've been going about it the wrong way, or maybe that was not the only way to protest against the war. We needed to understand that war can still happen despite the whole world being against it, or at least despite 90% of the world being against it. Look at the Occupy protests in America, where people were arguing that we are the 99%. So how is it that 1% oppressed is 99% still, despite you being in the majority?
I'm looking at time, first of all. This is such a fascinating conversation. I think we'll definitely come back to this and go into much more detail in the issues that you're dealing with. But I wanted to deal with, first of all, a few questions that already come to mind that I'm sure listeners are also wondering. The difference between your conception and systemic or institutionalized racism, not to say that these are synonymous, but just in terms of institutionalized racism, systemic racism, the fact that it is embedded in people's ways of being, in people's perceptions of the world, such that it such that you have individuals acting in the interests of this system, perhaps even unconsciously. How is your approach different from that? And future facing, we've identified the rates of oppression, we've identified the passbook, we've identified that apartheid finds loopholes and continues to exist. Where do we draw hope from this framework?
Thanks for those very important questions, Sean. So when we talk about the rate of oppression, Sean, people are not working on behalf of the system necessarily. They are not working against their own interests. People are feeding their children. People are sending their children to school. People are paying rent. It's not that people are advancing the interests of the system in detriment to their own. This is how the framework of apartheid studies is different. Mm-hmm. It shows that people are working in their own interests. Mm-hmm. But in working in their own interests, they are maintaining
their interests. Yeah.
Yes, they are, because this is like a parasitism that's happening here. Yeah. You see, a parasite wants you to leave. Mm-hmm. Because if you die, the parasite dies. So the parasite is not the one that introduces you to life or initiates life into you. You are already living, you're already walking, you're already eating food. Mm-hmm. But the parasite embeds itself into what you're already doing, mm-hmm. into the things that are you, into the things that make you. And you start feeding both your family and the parasite. Mm-hmm. So it's different to the picture that we have of all these other conceptions, let's say of institutionalized racism, which tries to put racism at a remove from you, the oppressed, mm-hmm. which tries to show that racism is them versus us. You know, you can actually see racism over there in that company, that institution, in that set of individuals who are doing it. I'm saying no, racism is in your very reflexes, in the very things you do every day. It is this thing that feed racism, not because you intend to, not because you love racism, but because racism is parasitic. Yes. So if you look at a virus is not mobile. It does not move, but it does not need to move because it simply infects you who can move. Mm-hmm. So a virus does not need to be mobile as long as people are mobile. It just needs to infect you and then you will move. So, but when you move, you're not moving on behalf of the virus, mm-hmm. right? You're going to work. But look at how the virus then is able to move from place to place because you are moving from place to place. You are not moving on behalf of the virus. You're just moving because it's your right to move because you're a human being or because you need to go to work. So I think this perspective will allow people to separate issues because it's been very difficult for people to separate these issues because people then start blaming you for transmitting the virus as if that's what you're moving for. Mm-hmm. That's what you're walking for. No, you're walking because human beings are supposed to walk. Uh-huh. But in walking from place to place, look at what you're doing. You're transmitting the virus. Mm-hmm. So what do you do now? Do you stop walking? Do you stop moving? Because, you know, once you move, you're also moving the virus along with you. This becomes an important question. And your second question was in relation to that. So what do we do? And the answer that I leave to my readers is I simply show that we need to close the loopholes. But you cannot close the loopholes unless you identify them. You need to know where they are. And I show where they are located in our everyday lives, in the things that matter to us, in the things that we value. I show where the loopholes are. Because I would like my readers to also buy the book, and because I would also like people to engage with us in the book, I'm not going to say everything, but in my book, I have laid out a framework for liberating ourselves from apartheid. I've shown how we can identify loopholes and how we can close them. Injustice happens in places and in ways that we do not identify with injustice. Oppression happens in ways and places that we do not readily identify with oppression happening, but that's because there are loopholes that allow it to do so. So if you can identify the loopholes, then all we need to do is to close them. Yeah. And this is the apartheid studies framework.
Last kind of a point that I'd like to ask, is there a specific way you think about race per se? Because speaking about the oppressor, I haven't heard a specific way in which whiteness is linked to oppression and linked to apartheid.
So in my book and in the whole apartheid studies framework, race figures in an important way. Mm-hmm. But race does not figure as intrinsic in itself. Basically, just because you are black or just because you are white, immediately the framework sorts you into a particular category. No, it doesn't do that. My framework does not do that. So for instance, I show that race actually coincides with apartheid. Like it coincides with it most of the time. But you can actually have apartheid beyond all these markers of race. And so this is a specific contribution that my framework does, because it shows that so the notion of black bodies, that is key to the apartheid studies framework. You could say, oh, black bodies. So he's talking about race now. He's using a racial element. He's talking about black people. But actually, no, I take the notion of black bodies from physics, right? Mm-hmm. Where a black body is a perfectly absorbent surface. It absorbs and absorbs and it doesn't give out anything in return, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like a shock absorber. But it keeps absorbing and absorbing and absorbing, and it doesn't reflect anything. That's a black body. And this notion of a black body coincides with what we see most black people living, the kinds of lives that they are living, the kinds of historical situations that they are in.
Oh, the idea of black bodies living in harm's way.
Yes, so they become, so there's a coincidence. There's a coincidence between racism and apartheid, for instance, a constant coincidence. And because there's this coincidence, it allows you to see that, yes, race is an important, you can't talk about apartheid studies without talking about race. But the way we talk about it is that we find all these surprising coincidences. Why is it that mostly in a particular situation is black people who are affected by it? And then what it opens up,
there are some black people who are not affected by it, right? Like a black American with an American passport is oppressed in has a different rate of oppression.
Yes,
a black African with a Ugandan passport.
Absolutely. When somebody comes from Chicago or New York, and they are an African American, and they go to Zimbabwe, for instance. You start to see a different rate of oppression apply, which allows them, for instance, to benefit from the fact that their rate is higher or less than people in those places that they are going to. But it doesn't have to be just Black Americans. It can be class. So the issue of class figures into apartheid studies a lot, but in a different way now, where if you are in the middle class, but you're African, you're black, and you go into a particular area where the fact that you're educated or not gives you or allocates you a particular rate of oppression. So I've been in situations where I've been treated differently just because people call me a professor, they hear that I'm a professor. And immediately they treat me differently. And you wonder why that is. And people are looking at the fact that, oh, he has got a degree or he's got a professorship. And they put that through the lottery and they allocate you a different rate of oppression and you benefit from that.
Indeed, I think of the example of like code switching between accents and the fact that when I walk into a particular space myself, I will channel the best English accent I have just so that I'm treated differently than a person who may not have the smoothest English accent. And that's true of multiple spaces. You choose.
Yes. Do you see how you have a menu? Yeah. Of ratios, all of them are there. You see, this is why I say it is different from intersectionality, because what you have is a range of options, of optional accents or menus, and you choose. When you study a situation and you pull out one that you think this is what's going to work here, so you don't have just one rate of oppression. You have a range of ratios that you are going to not choose, but that you are going to deploy. After an assessment, a calculation that you do. And so I've never seen a Black person whose consciousness is the same everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Throughout the day, you move through different manifestations of Black consciousness.
Yeah.
In one place, you're very radical. In another place, you're very accommodating. In another place, you're very open. In another place, you're very guarded.
Yeah.
It means you're always calculating, you're always learning the environment, observing your surroundings, and then there's a rate that you then apply. So the notion of a rate of oppression for me is one of the most, at least in my book, in my four volumes, is what I think is a very revolutionary contribution to the study of injustice and oppression. Because what it does is it puts the ball back in the court of the oppressed themselves. It shows that you are the ones without apportioning blame. In fact, you can actually feel empowered, right, about how you've been living your life. You no longer feel the need to hide, because you know everyone has their own menu of options. Everyone has their own ratios.
In this case, mm-hmm. the rate of oppression that equates to zero tends to coincide with whiteness.
Absolutely. I think you will see that the model that I've created, right, of people who are deep in shit and people who are full of shit, actually shows you how white people in general have manipulated a particular rate of oppression that is always close to zero, that density is very close to zero. And this is why, for instance, the white skin becomes a marker, let's say, of privilege. Right, is because it is linked to a very particular, there's a low rate of oppression in this particular case. And the passbook, what the passbook does, because white people did not carry passbooks in South Africa. That's how you would know that a person was a bus, right? They did not carry a passbook at all. Carrying a passbook becomes a marker of, so his rate of oppression is automatically high. And this is the coincidence with the rest that I was talking about. And so the rate of oppression for white people is very close to zero, or if you want, is minus, right? Minus one, minus two, minus three, depending on historical factors, depending on class factors, gender factors, social factors, and so on. So I'm hoping that when we study this notion of the rate of oppression and try to apply it wherever we are, whether it's in the Netherlands, whether it's in Brazil, whether it's in New York and Chicago, in Zimbabwe, Uganda, Kenya, whether it's in Mumbai, in India. I'm hoping that this is a framework that people can actually apply in particular contexts and see the loopholes in that particular context.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I'm your host, Sean Macheza. You've just been listening to a conversation with Nyasha Mboti, Associate Professor at the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein, South Africa, and the founder of Apartheid Studies. Thank you for listening this far. It's impossible to cover a whole field of study in the short time we had, but I hope this conversation has given a brief introduction to Nyasha Mboti's project. As a Zimbabwean myself and a person of color who is almost daily made aware of how white supremacy underlies the world we live in, I was very excited to talk to someone who had a new way of looking at what seems to be a very old problem, that of race and power. It'll take a lot more engagement and reading before I reach my conclusions, but this conversation definitely left me with much to think about. I hope it did the same for you. Make sure to listen to our previous episode on fighting corporate impunity in South Africa. This and other episodes is available from wherever you're streaming the State of Power podcast. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.